Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says it has launched a retaliatory missile attack on an Israeli center in Erbil, the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. Iranian parliamentarians demand sufficient political, technical, and economic guarantees from the U.S. in talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Day 18 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Russian forces have launched a missile attack on a major military base in the west near the Polish border. Tom Behrouz Najafi, welcome. Top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has conducted missile strikes on a strategic Israeli center in the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan region. The IRGC says its precision-guided missiles hit the strategic center in response to the crimes of the Zionists. The IRGC is warning Israel of a strong and destructive response if it repeats its acts of aggression. The footage emerged on Sunday of explosions in the Iraqi city of Erbil. Media reports later said the target had been secret centers operated by the Israeli spy agency Mossad. Earlier this week, two Iranian military advisors were killed in Israeli airstrikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Now, to discuss this a little, let's bring in Laif Maruf, activist and political commentator in Beirut, who is over the phone with us. Good to have you with us, Laif. So, let's hear your thoughts on what the IRGC is calling a response to the Zionist crimes.
It is very clear that the IRGC chose this target because of the multiple activities of destabilization and attacks that were conducted by the Mossad from the Erbil bases, specifically in the northeast of Iran, as we saw the demonstrations that were maneuvered by the Zionists and the Americans a few years ago from there, and the multiple attacks that happened on locations within the drone building factory and agencies in Iran. So this needs to be pointed out that is not directly related to what happened in Syria. The response to the attacks on Syria that led to the martyrdom of two servicemen from the Iranian military forces will be in Syria on the Israelis on that border. This is not related to that. It comes as a payback for other activities of attacks and destabilization by the Zionists inside Iran.
Okay, Laif Maruf, let's see and explore the reasons for Israel's presence in a country like Iraq, where people had just, with the help of Iran, got rid of ISIS, and you know, the Mossad ties with ISIS and the U.S. So the basic question is, what on earth is Israel's Mossad doing on Iraqi soil?
Well, the Zionists have been in contact with the Kurdish militias since the 1950s. We know clearly that the imperial forces have used the Kurdish cause over the last 60, 70 years, specifically to destabilize all the nations that have Kurdish minorities, Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And we know that this relation is long ongoing, and unfortunately for the Kurdish people of Iraq and Syria, who have been harmed really gravely by the Wahhabi contrast controlled by the United States, their leadership is giving them as a sacrifice to the imperial goals in the region. And this is why, it is important for the Kurdish people of Iraq, of Iran, of Syria, of Turkey, to rid themselves of this collaborative leadership that has been putting them in harm's way for the agenda of the Zionists and the Americans.
And, you know, on another note, like Israel, as you well know, has been, you know, violating international law. It's violating the Lebanese airspace. It's also doing the same with the Syrian airspace. It's using drones to target, you know, well, inside Syria and elsewhere. But the international organizations are just standing idle by and saying nothing.
Because really, it's a euphemism to call them international organizations. These are organizations that are captured by the empire and have been subservient to it since their creation. Unfortunately, much of the institutions that were created after World War II have shown they are useless, and we are living right now an important moment in history when it's very clear for everybody how useless these organizations are, and we are moving towards a new world with multipolarity, and we should be looking forward to the creation of actual organizations that represent humanity and not only the interests of the West.
And Laith, Iran, if you remember, had promised that it would not sit idle by, and in case of any aggression, it could have the response that reserves the right for this. And this is what Iran has done. So it looks like that maybe in the minds of some people and analysts that the regional equations are undergoing some kind of change with such a stance adopted by the Islamic Republic.
Definitely, there is change happening on the ground, and this, you know, if you look globally, this is happening all around, not only in our region of West Asia. It is the moment right now for Iran and the axis of resistance to respond to the provocations and the constant attacks and violations by the Zionists. As we see the Russian military and the Russian government responding to the provocations that are happening in Ukraine for over 6 years. And this is important right now because the United States is withdrawing from most of the region, wants to not only confront Iran, but also wants to confront China and Russia and Venezuela and everybody that can put their head up. And therefore, the United States is not capable really to take on anybody. And it is the moment for liberation and for the peoples of the region to, you know, draw their own future without the interference of the Americans.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and insights. Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator in Beirut. Now moving on, Iranian lawmakers have called for the ongoing negotiations in Vienna to result in an effective removal of all sanctions. In a statement, legislators said that a partial removal of sanctions on paper will not ensure the rights of the Iranian people. The parliamentarians called on the Iranian negotiating team not to feel hamstrung by the fake deadline set by the West and to follow up on Tehran's key demands without delay and ensure that its red lines are respected. They also urged negotiators to ask the American side for sufficient economic, technical, and political guarantees that Washington won't unilaterally withdraw from the agreement as it did last time. The MPs underlined that any possible agreement must ensure Iran's economic benefits and the rights of the people. An exhibition has opened in Yemeni capital Sana'a to introduce part of the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition during 7 years of the war and blockade. The exhibition is organized by students of the Sana'a University. Abdellatif El-Washali has the story.
To remind the world of years of bloodshed and destruction by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, Sana'a University has hosted an exhibition displaying drawings and photos of the war with subtitles in different languages, including Persian.
We finished seven. We get inside the 8 year in aggression. So, as you say, they bombed all fatal facilities, and they destroyed our infrastructure, and the situation has become dire, and the health disaster, including malnutrition. So we may not the most affected group is the children.
During the inauguration ceremony, organizers praised the role of resistance media outlets in supporting the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes being committed against civilians by the Saudi led coalition.
Really thank press for coming today. They're debating really a good thing. They're representing us in the Western countries, to the European countries, and also and we just come to the reality that we're really besieged through military stuff. Through media.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions of others have been suffering from the Saudi-led war and siege since 2015. Unfortunately, the mainstream Western media keep turning a blind eye to the crimes and violations against Yemenis.
Despite the wounds inflicted by years of the Saudi-led war, this exhibition proves that art and creativity are still alive in Yemen. Organizers say the exhibition gives a clear idea of suffering millions of Yemenis have endured. It is also an attempt to revive the conscience of the world, which has seemingly died along with hundreds of thousands of innocent Yemenis. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Time now for the news review program. Saudi Arabia's execution of 81 people in one day over alleged terrorism-related charges is drawing huge criticism. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War has condemned the mass killings, warning of serious consequences for the Al Saud regime. A number of Iraqi political movements, including Asaib al-Haq and Nujaba movements, have also blasted the executions in the strongest terms. The killings took place on Saturday, with reports saying that over 40 of them were from the Shia-majority Qatif region. This is Saudi Arabia's highest number of recorded executions in one day. Among them were members of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement, too, the Saudi Interior Ministry saying that those executed were accused of deviant beliefs in collaboration with Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups. No court documents are available to verify those allegations. Time now for some insight and analysis. So I'm inviting Alfred de Zayas, former Secretary of the Human Rights Committee at the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights from Geneva. Now, Alfred, you were a human rights official with the UN for a long year. So let us have your thoughts on the rights situation in Saudi Arabia, especially after MBS took the helm.
As you may know, Saudi Arabia is not a state party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that has about 170 states parties, not a state party to the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So I had no opportunity to examine the Saudi record. Of course, we have the Universal Periodic Review of the Human Rights Council, but that is a highly political body. And it is more of a diplomatic ritual than a real investigation. As the case may be, it is clear that executing 81 persons in one day is very shocking. Some 145 countries do not practice capital punishment anymore, and I wish that this abolitionist movement will continue. It is problematic that many of those executed were executed for political offenses. And obviously, that is an additional violation. Also, we don't know as to the execution of minors. I know that last year, in 2021, Saudi Arabia executed Mustafa al-Darwish, who was accused when he was 17 years old of having plotted a terrorist act to execute. Now, fair trials in Saudi Arabia, big question mark. We just simply don't have the evidence. And beyond that, a country that is capable of murdering a journalist, the Khashoggi case, and dismembering that individual. I mean, the depth of criminality is such that it boggles the mind. Now, 81 executions is bad, but what is really, really bad is the humanitarian catastrophe that Saudi Arabia and my country, the United States of America, have visited upon the people of Yemen. This, without a doubt.
All right. Thank you very much, Alfred de Zayas. Okay, Russia is carrying out the 18th day of its military campaign in Ukraine. Russian forces have hit a major military facility with missiles. According to regional officials, 8 missiles were fired at the base in western Ukraine, just 25 kilometers from the Polish border. Regional governors saying the attack killed 9 people and injured 57 more. Russian forces also launched attacks at the airport in the western city of Ivano-Frankivsk. Defense Ministry says it has so far destroyed more than 3,600 military facilities. In the capital, Kiev, residents woke up to air raid sirens this morning. The Russian forces have advanced closer to Kiev from the north, west, and northeast. Ukrainian officials saying the attacks and threats of air raids are hindering attempts to evacuate civilians from surrounded areas. Nearly 2.6 million people, mostly women and children, have fled to neighboring countries. Now, in the meantime, France and Germany have renewed their calls on Russia for a ceasefire in Ukraine and diplomatic solution to the conflict. At a conference, a phone call, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and French President Emmanuel Macron called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to lift the days-long siege of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Macron referred to allegations of rights abuses by Russian soldiers, warning they may amount to war crimes. Over the past days, diplomatic efforts by world leaders to end the Ukraine conflict have made no progress. Kiev says it remains open to diplomacy, but won't give in to ultimatums. And that's all we had for you for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Shir Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Shir Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Guadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khur-e Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth, it's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khur-e Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilag. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people. Traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he has ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people, proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. This is The Lantern, and thank you very much for joining us on this brand new episode of the show, coming to you not live from the studios of IRIB English Radio. I'm a firm believer that too much of anything can be destructive. Anything. Anything. I regret to say even chai. I can't live without chai. I'm not even ashamed of it. I admit, I confess, I cannot live without chai. But unfortunately, I mean, I don't know what science has been doing for the past few thousand years, but even too much of chai can, you know, have harmful effects. It's sad, but it's true. Too much of water, too much of a good food, too much of too much supplements, even too much vitamin D in our system, too much iron, too much calcium, all of that. A hadith tells us that there's only one thing that you can never have too much of. And we'll find out what it is right after this short little story, heartfelt story about a father and his wholesome prayer for his baby girl. And we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear friend, salam. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. Today we have a new story. Let's see what's our story for today. Wish You Enough. That is the title of today's story. At an airport, I overheard a father and a daughter in their last moments together. They had announced her plans departure and standing near the door. He said to his daughter, I love you. I wish you enough. she said. Daddy, a life together has been more than enough. Your love is all I ever needed. I wish you enough too, Daddy. They kissed goodbye and she left. He walked over toward the window where I was seated. Standing there, I could see he wanted and needed to cry. I tried not to intrude on his privacy, but he welcomed me in by asking, "Did you ever say goodbye to someone knowing it would be forever?" "Yes, I have," I replied. Saying that brought back memories I had of expressing my love and appreciation for all my dad had done for me, recognizing that his days were limited. I took the time to tell him face to face how much he meant to me. So I knew what this man was experiencing. "Forgive me for asking, but why is this forever goodbye?" I asked. "I'm old and she lived much too far away. I have challenges ahead and the reality is her next trip back will be for my funeral," he said. "When you were saying goodbye, I heard you say, 'I wish you enough.' May I ask what that means?" He began to smile. "That is a wish that has been handed down from other generations. My parents used to say it to everyone." He paused for a moment and looking up as if trying to remember it in detail, he smiled even more. "When we said, 'I wish you enough,' we were wanting the other person to have a life filled with enough good things to sustain them." He continued and then turning toward me, he shared the following as if he were reciting it from memory. "I wish you enough sun to keep your attitude bright. I wish you enough rain to appreciate the sun more. I wish you enough happiness to keep your spirit alive. I wish you enough pain so that the smallest joys in life appear much bigger. I wish you enough gain to satisfy your wanting. I wish you enough loss to appreciate all that you possess. I wish enough hellos to get you through the final goodbye." He then began to sob and walked away.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Okay, so we all want happiness and peace and joy and pleasure in life, right? But as weird as it is, because like happiness and pleasure is such a physical need, and it's acquired through our physical faculties, we can't have it all in this world. It's ironic, isn't it? We can't have it all. If we have our priorities, I mean, to be honest, even for those whose life's sole purpose is to acquire pleasure and happiness, there's still something in them, there's still a void that makes them ache for more and more and more. It will never be enough. That's the quality of this world. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has said that this material world is like seawater, like salt water. The more you drink from it, the thirstier you'll become until you die, until it kills you, basically. And the saying that goes, you can never have too much of a good thing, is definitely false. Anyone with the slightest bit of common sense will recognize that there is so totally too much of a good thing. Even a child would understand that. Children usually love cookies. They can have maybe up to 6 cookies if they, you know, they're into that life. Turn that 6 cookies into 26 cookies and they'd never want to have a cookie ever again for the rest of their lives. A cookie is so good for them. Cookie is so good to them. But when it exceeds a certain limit, it's no longer good for them. And they understand that. Their body understands that. They puke it all out. The point is that everything is good in moderation. Everything. Ibadah, spending money, charity, fasting, engaging with others, socializing, studying, working, sleeping, eating, showering. Everything is only good in moderation. And once it exceeds a certain limit, that very thing that you rejoiced in acquiring will turn into poison for you. All right, but then how about the things that are kind of, their consumption is sort of out of our control, you know, like life events, the tests and trials, the happiness or the sadness, the stress or the relief that life brings us. So there are two things to this, I think, from what I've understood through my journey throughout life. It's been a short journey, but nevertheless. Either I have faith that everything that happens in this world happens through Allah's will, and if He gives it to me, He most probably thinks I can still handle it. لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Right? If I am still experiencing some degree of discomfort or pain or suffering through circumstances that are totally out of my control, in the sense that I tried my utter best, but at the end it didn't work out and things still fell apart and I ended up crying myself to sleep for a week, then most probably Allah felt that, yeah, no, she can totally handle this and she's going to grow through this, and it's a process she has to go through for her own betterment and for her own growth and for the expansion of her mind and her soul. And then when it's just enough, Allah will bless me with faraj, with a relief. Or, you know, often things are just the result of my own stupid decisions. And maybe it's about time that I stop being stupid and do something about it. Maybe, you know, that's enough stupidity for this lifetime or for this year. And again, I will suffer through that just enough for myself to realize, you know, if I've trained myself enough and I've educated myself enough. Because some people, it is very possible for some people to go through their entire life while suffering due to a very deep ignorance, or like a complex ignorance, a compound ignorance. But if I have educated myself enough and I've read up enough and I've refined myself enough, just enough to realize after a while that, you know what? This situation sucks. And you know what? I don't think I've tried enough to fix it. And then you do. And then things change for the better. Because on the other hand, Allah also says, Allah will not change a people or what's happening with a people until they change what's within themselves. So there's a balance going on, and you know, you just have to find that sweet spot and recognize when is it usually the result of my own actions, or sometimes even my own sins, my own ill decision making. But so long as you develop that trait in yourself to always try your best, You can have faith in God to only give you something until, especially something painful, until it's just enough. But then again, it's your life. You know best. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. في أمان الله.
أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.